So, you know, I've been teaching this class, Tech in the City, at the business school for a couple years, and I'm loving it because my students are super entrepreneurial and they are always asking me for advice on their startup ideas. But I've noticed something fascinating about them all. They pitch such diverse startup ideas to me, but then they ask me the exact same question. And it's not about funding, it's not about the tech. They all want to know, should they ask for permission or should they beg for forgiveness?
Well, okay, Professor Turner, what is your answer? Should they ask cities for permission before they launch, or launch, grow really fast, and then beg for forgiveness if they run afoul of city rules?
Well, it wouldn't be my favorite question if it had a simple answer. So take a seat, because class is in session. Welcome to Technopolis, where technology is disrupting, remaking, and sometimes overrunning our cities. I'm Molly Turner. I teach urban innovation at the Berkeley Haas School of Business, and I was the first policy person at Airbnb.
And I'm Jim Capsis. I was a climate negotiator in the Obama administration, and now I advise tech startups. In particular, I help them figure out what regulation and policy mean for their business and what they need to do to succeed because of, and sometimes in spite of, the rules.
Which is perfect for this episode about urban tech and its pesky habit of breaking all the rules. Today, we're going to dig into a central question for urban startups. Should they ask for permission or beg for forgiveness from the cities they're trying to disrupt?
Exactly, Molly. There's a reason this question is so top of mind for your students and the leadership teams of tech startups. When new tech shows up in cities, whether you're talking about ride-hailing or Airbnb, scooters, whatever, everyone has something to say about it, particularly at city council meetings.
My wife was riding her stairlift down our front stairs on Sunday as four bird scooters came up in tandem up the sidewalk.
I'm a personal scooter owner, then I want people to not look at me in a bad light for providing just an alternative to get to and from where I work.
The Uber cars, they have to go in inspection like the yellow cab drivers, we go every 4 months. You cannot have
different rules for one. When you move someplace new, it's really hard to go ahead and find a new job. Uber allows me to go ahead.
About widows with fixed incomes, do they not have the right to utilize it as an Airbnb?
City Hall might prioritize rising real estate values to increase tax revenues without a tax increase. But what good is more revenue for services for people who can no longer afford to live here?
You know, I've attended my share of angry public meetings, but I've never quite been in the hot seat before. When they were talking about Airbnb, they were probably looking right at you.
Yeah, it was tough, but that was the job. And like we just heard in the tape, folks had really strong arguments on both sides. So while of course I was there to support the concerns of our hosts, I also really empathized with the concerns of their neighbors who were worried about housing costs and building safety. Those were really valid points.
But that's the genius of the beg for forgiveness strategy, right? By the time the city council meetings came around, Airbnb already had huge user numbers. The tech had been implanted in the market.
Yeah, you're right. By the time I started at Airbnb as the first policy person, the company was already 3 years old and operating in hundreds of cities. I mean, I advocated for asking for permission back then, and we did that. But, I mean, it certainly helped that the business was already well underway.
It does provide the perfect thought experiment for our topic today. Here's my question for you, Mal. What do you think Airbnb would be like if they negotiated all those cities before allowing people to use their platform? You know, ask them for actual permission. Would they be bigger, smaller, or they'd just be out of business?
Okay, let's do the math. Most city zoning laws didn't really address Airbnb's business model, meaning we would have had to lobby cities to pass new legislation before we could operate in any of them. On average, that takes about 2 years per city.
So long.
And you need at least one person focused on that city the entire time, and that person has to get paid.
Uh-huh.
And then multiply that by hundreds of cities that you want to operate in. Airbnb would have run out of money really fast. I don't think it would exist today. But, you know, Jim, if you're so interested in my lessons from Airbnb, you should just take my class.
Well, I actually taught a masterclass on this question of permission versus forgiveness while you were on winter break in New Zealand.
Yeah, a little birdie told me, and I'm kind of pissed you did that without me.
I'm kind of pissed you were in New Zealand, but don't worry. I got Bradley Tusk, Uber's first political strategist, and Salita Reynolds, Los Angeles' head of transportation, to join me for a live debate on this topic at the Brooklyn Podcast Festival. And we sold out the show.
Those are great gets, Jim. I honestly can't decide who would win that debate. I mean, Bradley worked for Mayor Bloomberg for a little while, and now he's a venture capitalist. While Salida, on the other hand, is at the front lines of tech, but from the city's side. I'm so sorry I missed it.
Well, Molly, this was a podcast festival, so we have the tape. Let's listen. You can tell me what you think after. In reading your book, which was released last year, you talk a little bit about Travis's Law. And in thinking about the history of Uber, if we're starting at the beginning, tell us, who is Travis, and what was his law?
Sure. So Travis is a guy named Travis Kalanick. Depending on how much you like or hate Uber, he's the guy to either appreciate or blame for that. But Travis's Law effectively became the game plan for how ride sharing became legal all over the U.S. And the same thing we're doing now with companies like Bird, which is when you've got a new startup that's taking away market share from an entrenched interest, and that entrenched interest has lobbyists and campaign donations, lots of political power, you can't fight them on their own terms because you don't have the resources to do so. So what we tried doing with Uber, and we kind of tested it out once or twice and it really worked, is mobilizing our own customers instead to advocate, to say, hey, this is a good law, this is a bad law, whatever it is. And over the course of probably 4 years, a couple of million people across the U.S. tweeted, emailed, called, in various ways engaged in the process, and we were able to overwhelm kind of all the local typical politics as a result. So that's why ride-sharing is legal, you know.
Bradley, when you distilled it in the book, if I remember correctly, it was the difference between whether startups should ask for permission or beg for forgiveness.
In certain cases like Uber, taxi was a cartel. They had never improved their product. They didn't want competition. And if we didn't break the cartel, we wouldn't exist right now. So in that case, we begged for forgiveness. If you take Bird as an example, we're doing both. There are markets around the U.S. where we look at the law and says nothing says we can't have an electric scooter here. And we do. And we still have to deal with DOT. And sometimes they're mad and sometimes they're not. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. And there are other places like here in New York, Philly, Seattle, Chicago, where the law is pretty clear that we can't do it, in which case we're passing legislation and asking for permission.
What's your view on this? I mean, should
yeah, I guess
be
my definition of Travis's law might be a little different from my seat.
I thought you might say that
because it kind of worked until it didn't, right? It didn't actually play out that way in Austin, Texas, for example, where both Uber and Lyft put a ballot measure on the ballot to try and get their market to override city council and allow them in. And the people said, no, thank you. The challenge, I think, for cities is particularly large cities like Los Angeles or cities that end up being kind of the tip of the spear like San Francisco, the challenge becomes a lack of knowledge and insight and information about how the mobility in the city is changing. Because while at first it was absolutely true that Uber and Lyft were taking trips away from taxis, what ended up happening over time is that those ride-hailing companies take trips from every other mode, including trips that could be otherwise made by foot or on bike or on transit, and they actually increase the number of trips that people make overall. But also, those trips are now happening in cars. And that's because there's another law, which is called induced demand, which is when you make it easier to drive, people drive. And Uber and Lyft really enable more sort of driving. So I think that's the challenge for cities in a nutshell is not so much that there's innovation and new thinking and disruption happening in transportation, but there's a lack of kind of technology companies doing their homework about some other very basic laws that we know to be true about people's transportation habits.
Bradley, do you agree with that? Are tech companies not doing their homework?
I mean, tech companies have a different job than bureaucrats and policy experts and things like that.
Public servants.
Public servants, of which I was one for
Thank
a long
you.
Time.
Bureaucrats, not a four-letter word.
So, look, I think ultimately, take Bird as an example. Bird is the bane of lots of DOT commissioners' existences across the country. But at the end of the day, if the constituents, the people who they're supposed to serve, who pay the taxes, that pay their salaries, didn't want to use electric scooters, we wouldn't have a company like this. There wouldn't be four or five companies like this all growing at this pace. And it's not just a question of like Silicon Valley investors or New York investors like me throwing money at them. The usership is just skyrocketing. So I would argue that the job of the public servants is to figure out what their constituents want and figure out how to make it work in a way that is logical and sensible, which doesn't always mean doing what I want, right? I understand that.
There's a natural tension there, right? Where, yes, there's a market for people who want to use a product, and maybe that enables a company to build wealth or to build value. But then the city's goals are a little different, right? The city's goals are to build safe, beautiful streets, to keep people from dying, to help people get around, to solve racial and socioeconomic inequities, and really to improve people's quality of life. And what that often means is that there has to be a sort of a menu of ways for people to get around, and the consequences of their actions have to be transparent to them. So if you choose to drive by yourself for a short trip that you could otherwise use a scooter, or you could take transit, or you could bike and walk, right now that choice is free to you. There's zero consequence. But it actually does a real harm towards the collective good and the big problems that we're trying to solve in cities. And that's where I think that there is an overlap in that Venn diagram of making money and doing good. And I think we're starting to move towards that. I would say that the arrival of companies like Bird and Lime and others create, hopefully, a constituency not just to preempt cities out of regulating them, but also to advocate for better street design and to advocate for safer ways for people to get around without getting in their car.
Sure. I mean, you'll see here in New York, the biggest issue in Albany, or one of them, will be congestion pricing. And I think, surprisingly, you'll see a lot of support from tech transportation startups for that. The idea is that you would pay some sort of fee if you drove, depending, variable pricing, depending on time and day and all that other stuff, with the goal of deterring traffic, which I think is a pretty worthy one. But I think you'll see a lot of New York startups supportive of this, because ultimately having a logical, sensible transportation system is better for everyone. Right? Like, we can't succeed long-term and make money either if it's just total chaos.
So there's challenges on both sides, right? There's a fair amount of entitlement on the technology side, and a sense that if you do try and understand a problem deeply, that will inhibit your ability to disrupt it. On the city and government side, there's such a sort of hand of God approach on regulation and control that the way that we're providing services right now is not working for people, full stop. There are tremendous individual returns on investment if we can bring mobility providers and private mobility providers into the city to do that. But in order to let that happen, we have to let go of control. But in order to provide something that solves a real problem, Silicon Valley needs to let go of entitlement.
I think what's interesting is there's ultimately two different scenarios, and they play out in very different ways. So way one is there's an entrenched interest, startup comes along with a different way to do it because it's kind of a different concept. It's not clear in law as to how it should work. And when they start taking market share away, the entrenched interest starts complaining to the politicians they give money to, who lean on the regulators, and then you battle it out. And that tends to be a lot more where there's three people. There's the entrenched interest, the startup, and the government, and everyone's kind of negotiating with each other. And then the second one would be totally new ideas like autonomous vehicles or cryptocurrency or drones, where there is no regulation, right? And in many cases, actually, I think the startups want it. Like, so we're investors in companies like Coinbase and Circle. We really want regulation around crypto, because right now this is going to separate all the bad actors who are doing fraudulent ICOs from legitimate exchanges like the ones that we're investors in. So I think you almost have to look at, is there something that's totally new, or is there something that already exists?
We cannot prop up ad hoc regulations for every new device. And so the business model was about opening up ubiquitous mobility in the palm of your hand in an app store. But when you open your app in Google or Apple's app store, you agree to a set of terms and conditions. But you're also opening up that app in my app store in the public realm. And we don't have that same sort of checklist. So we're trying to begin to make a play to create that. And we're building it in open source so that no matter who you are, no matter what your innovation is, the rules are really clear for you and you know how to come into the city of Los Angeles, and we're expressing our policy through technology.
Say more about what you've done in LA and how you've created that, and what's been the response from the tech community?
Sure. So about 3 years ago, we wrote this document that really laid out what we think is a roadmap for the city to change its role fundamentally in inviting in technology into transportation. And so when scooters arrived, it was a moment where we actually did have the, you know, companies asking to be regulated, and it was clear that we had regulatory authority. And so we published on GitHub two sets of APIs, and we made it clear that if you wanted to operate a scooter in Los Angeles, you had to abide by those APIs. The first set...
What What's GitHub?
It's an open source community for developers. So when you publish code in GitHub, anybody can comment on it. Anybody can request to add to it. Anybody can ask questions about it. We're doing everything out in the open. It's super transparent. The first set of code just says, you know, I'm not going to learn your language. You're going to come to public school and learn one language so that I don't have to ask and interpret your data the way that it comes. You're going to give it to me in a consistent format. But it's the second set of code that's really the big leap forward that says, instead of me poking you on the shoulder and saying, hey, can I please have your data? I'm going to be in your product workflow. So when you are on a scooter and you want to end that ride, the app is going to ping the city's operating system and say, can I park here? And the city's operating system is going to answer back. So that is a real shift. And in so doing, I'm regulating the public right-of-way the same way that I do now, but I'm earning data instead of asking for
data. You've created your own app store.
I have, yes.
That's pretty neat.
And the code doesn't say scooter. The code says trip.
Right.
So no matter what you are, no matter if you're a car sharing car, if you're a any of the other sort of mobility devices that are showing up, we're saying, hey, build to this specification and you can come and operate in Los Angeles. We had about a dozen cities that started using them right away and writing them into their regulations. And then we actually had private companies saying, we're a car sharing company that operates in, you know, a dozen cities worldwide, and we want all of our cities to use the same approach. And then there were even another set of companies that said, we're going to build a product that sits on top of this that provides data visualization or gives cities the tools to actually operationalize what the code is enabling. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of amazing that for 10 years I'd try to, you know, knock on tech's door and say, hey, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And then, you know,
respect a spy's
like and they were like, I'm sorry, we don't speak bureaucrat. Right. But then
public service, I thought was the language. Come on.
Right. I get it. You all think I'm a bureaucrat.
Are you still seeing, Salita, like, sort of egregious examples of tech companies just not getting it in terms of interactions that you've had, you know, with companies pitching you the things that are just out there or doing things that you wish they wouldn't do?
I think in general, yes. I think in general, the greater the level of hype, the more of that there is. So I will give you just a little story. Let's call them air taxis, right? So autonomous drones that are meant to carry humans. I went to visit CES last year, Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. I'm standing in a semicircle with three men who work for me. And the gentleman from this company shakes one guy's hand, another guy's hand passes right over me, and shakes another guy's hand and another guy's hand. And, you know, so I have to assert that actually I'm the one in charge of the $120 billion over the next 40 years.
What was his name and the company, and please?
Well, and then what was fascinating is that it just went, watch what I'm about to do here, went right over their heads, aviation company.
I like it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. See what I did there? But that they would have to work with the city at all. And I said, well, you know, FAA may let you fly, but it's cities that are going to let you land, right? The wheels were turning slowly. Mm-hmm. There's no lack of enthusiasm, but there's a real lack of understanding what cities are dealing with on an everyday basis. And to have a true sort of partnership, my worries have to be your worries, and your worries have to be my worries. And there's plenty of terrible examples that I could give you on the city side of the way that we miss out on opportunities because we do not think of ways to find wins for private companies and businesses that at the end of the day really do need to make money.
So to that point, Bradley, tell us a story about a really awful experience you had with a public servant. We'll call them.
Look, I think across the board, in my view, a bad experience with a public servant is not one where they disagree with you. Like, disagreement's fine. The mindset that's usually problematic for us isn't so much, like, if someone's willing to engage in a legitimate debate, if you take scooters, should they ride on the sidewalk, the street, a bike lane, should you have insurance required, helmets? Like, those are really fair, reasonable questions, and we're not right in our answers for all of them. But when it's, you can't do it because I don't know about this thing, or I don't like it, or the people I regulate don't want it, and they give my boss campaign contributions, that's when you run into trouble. When a regulator says, that's not my concern, my concern is what's good for the public, and I'll balance all the competing needs, that's great. When the regulator says, if it's not good for you, I'll just go ahead and try to shut them down, that's not great. And that's when we have to turn on, you know, 20,000 customers or whatever it is, basically to go over their heads.
Don't go anywhere. There's more Technopolis right after this quick break. 20,000 customers. It's pretty incredible to think that you could mobilize that many people around an app or anything. I mean, people love Airbnb, but we could only muster a couple hundred people.
Yeah, but isn't the difference, Molly, that with Uber, there was this bad guy, right? There were the taxi industry that they could, you know, run a campaign against. But with Airbnb, like, who are you going to run against? There was no bad guy in that situation.
You're totally right. But Travis's law doesn't always work, even for Uber. Just look what happened in Austin. So I think 39,000 Austinites voted to keep Uber and Lyft, but 49,000 voted to kick them out.
And keep Austin weird. Yeah, I've always been curious what happened there. I used to go to Austin all the time for work before Uber and Lyft, and it was literally the worst town ever to try to get a taxi in. So it seemed primed for Uber and Lyft. So they come in, they're loved at first. It seemed like their strategy, you know, begging forgiveness was working. And then poof, what happened to make so many people in Austin turn on them?
Because there's another important law a lot of these tech companies have learned the hard way. Don't be a jerk.
Our next guest, Nina Hernandez, can give us some insight into that. She's a staff writer at the Austin Chronicle, covering local politics. We asked her why Austinites reacted the way they did to Uber and Lyft showing up in town.
Well, I mean, they launched during South by Southwest. You know, I remember it. People, especially my friends in tech, you know, who were like, this is going to change the world, man. You know, transportation is solved.
So then what happened? Like a couple years later, Austin has a measure on the ballot where the public actually gets to decide whether Uber and Lyft get to stay, and Austinites voted to boot them out. So what happened between this warm welcome and that ballot measure to change public opinion?
Essentially, I think overplaying their hand a little bit on the part of Uber and Lyft. They had all these arguments for why the service was so essential. People were going crazy over it. And so, in response to, regulatory efforts by the city, they spent a bunch of money to combat it. And so it became less about the merits of the regulation and more about, man, Uber and Lyft are spending all this money. We're getting all this direct mail. We're getting canvassers coming to our door and bothering us, you know, when we're out and about. Just Austin's general attitude towards corporate intervention, essentially.
Oh, interesting.
You're not going to just dismantle what our city council has put together in terms of regulation because we voted those people in. And then,
so they just went too hard. They just went too hard. People
yes.
liked the services. City council put in some restrictions and said, you got to play by our rules. They said, screw you. We're not going to play by your rules. And the public was like, we're on city council side on this. Like, you should play by our rules here. And they grew a distaste for Uber and Lyft at that time. Is that a fair characterization?
Absolutely. Although I will say Austin's, you know, breakup with Uber and Lyft was super short-lived.
So what happened? Austinites voted them out. Uber and Lyft closed up shop, decided to leave. Then what happened?
People were scrambling for rides. Like a dozen different rideshare apps like pop up in the market overnight.
Didn't the state come in and kind of say, you know, Austin, good, you know, nice try. We're not going to abide by a referendum. You have to allow these services to
right. So
to serve your city.
Definitely the money tactic. While Austin is a kind of a principled city, unfortunately, that does not translate to the state level. I mean, the state legislature, anything Austin likes, they love to kill. So.
Blue city, red state.
Right, that dynamic.
Shut it down.
You basically.
What was the reaction in Austin when that happened? When they got overturned, was there an outcry?
Well, I mean, number one, we're used to it. So there's that. And then also there were like crazy incentives. It was so cheap to ride Uber, especially Lyft. I mean, it was just insane. So people went back to it.
At the end of the day, maybe. Maybe these tech folks are right. You know, you make something cheaper or more delightful than everyone else, and it doesn't matter how you act, they'll still use it.
Mm-hmm.
But so was it the same? Like, when these companies came and dumped the scooters on the sidewalks in Austin, how'd people react?
I would say people were thrilled at first, honestly. They, like,
why?
You know, people were, like, videoing themselves on it, and it was all over Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, and just people talking about, you know, the wind in your hair. Even me, man, I was reporting on something at the courthouse, and I took one around the block, and I just thought, man, this is so fun. You know what I mean? It's just like the response was enthusiastic. People were having a good time. And then the market just got saturated, and all of a sudden there was just scooters kind of everywhere, and people started getting annoyed by, you know, people doing what they're technically supposed to, riding in the street, people in bike lanes, people on sidewalks, you know, hitting other people or, you know, dodging in and out of foot traffic. And so it just sort of became a meme to hate scooters.
I mean, it strikes me, scooters are kind of different from like Uber and Lyft, because it seems like the reaction is really not to how the companies are acting in this case, but to how Austinites are misbehaving. You know, it's the people in Austin who are parking the scooters in the wrong place, or who are, you know, rudely cutting off pedestrians or cyclists in the bike lane. So, like, do you get the sense, Nina, that, you know, it's an anger for your fellow Austinite and not necessarily directed at the tech companies?
The key difference, I think, is that, you know, Uber and Lyft, they're just very sensitive when it comes to any kind of employee-employer relationship with their drivers. Mm-hmm. They were always going to be fundamentally at odds with the city's effort to essentially treat their drivers like regular employees. And so with the scooters, it's just nowhere near as combative. I mean, yes, the city was annoyed, but they actually never even really punished the companies that didn't follow the rules.
You know, you've said a lot of people have reacted positively until they get to know some of these companies, or you kind of see the effects of it, and then public opinion changes. But do you get the sense, like, who's winning or losing in these cities when these companies operate? Is there, like, a common denominator? A certain kind of person is always winning and a certain kind of person's always losing?
What I always come back to when I'm talking about these, you know, credit card-based or debit card-based apps, you know, especially when they are talked about as a beacon of social change, ultimately, the poorest of us, those of us who can't afford smartphones or can't afford them all the time, there are reasons why these apps leave out a certain demographic of people. So when we're talking about winners and losers, I mean, obviously, the tech industry is here making money. And it seems like, as we discussed, no matter how they choose to play their hand, pretty much, there are ways to come out on top if you're providing a service that ultimately people want to use. You know, those old, outdated industries, they would be a loser, in my opinion. And then also, I would say people who are left out, because this technology isn't accessible to everybody. And I don't know of a way to change that except to address inequality on a larger scale.
That's the role for government to play, is to sort of help figure out, right, how to prioritize the needs of those people. They're the ones who need the most help. And they're not being helped always by, as you said, right, these app-driven companies, because they don't fit into their business model.
Exactly.
Nina's exactly right, and I make this point to my class all of the time. One of the reasons governments fight with these startups is because they're actually fighting for citizens who are left behind by technology. You know, for example, I really like scooters. I advise a scooter company, but there's still this issue about how scooters are going to coexist on sidewalks alongside people with physical disabilities.
There are real winners and losers.
Yeah.
I mean, as soon as the scooters launch, the able-bodied people get to zip around on them. But if you're someone with disabilities and you have to wait until the city can sort out all the right-of-ways, I mean, what a pain.
And there are other possible scenarios for winners and losers, though. If cities made room for scooters on the street by taking away space from cars, and building more bike lanes, then the car drivers would lose.
Your favorite.
The bicyclists would win. And then pedestrians and folks with disabilities actually get their sidewalk space back.
Yeah, and that would require the city to have some advanced notice, though, wouldn't it? I mean, they need a plan for all of those new bike lanes. Salita made a comment about that. She said that if the scooter companies and the cities could work together, they could make for safer streets. But that's not always the way it happens.
No, it's definitely not. Most of the time, they beg for forgiveness. And who wins and who loses when they do that depends on what kind of a company it is and what my needs as a citizen are.
And it's the city's job to balance all those winners and losers, which is when things get really interesting. So, Molly, we started this episode to help your radical Berkeley MBA students decide whether to ask for permission or beg for forgiveness when they launch their world-changing urban tech startups. So what are we going to tell them?
Well, citizens, at least some of them, lose out when cities don't have any idea that the tech is coming their way. It'd be great if tech founders spent more time thinking about how their products will affect a wider range of people. But in reality, that responsibility is going to fall to cities every time. So cities should be included earlier on.
I think you're mostly right, Mal, but how long can we afford to wait while we go through that civic cost-benefit paralysis analysis?
Yeah.
What solutions and exciting innovations are we sleeping on?
I don't think there are that many scenarios where people need a startup solution so urgently that they can't wait for that civic process to play out. I mean, I like my ride hail as much as the next gal, but it's not the polio vaccine. You know, I could have waited for it, but the business might not have been able to wait.
Yeah. What startup has the runway to survive so long without customers, though? So I do understand why some companies feel the need to launch first and beg for forgiveness later, because for some, the whole question is a false choice. If they try to ask for permission or if they're too differential, they're dead.
I know some city planners who would say, well, if you die while you're waiting for permission, too bad, not my problem.
Right. Well, that's why Bradley's comment about context matters so much. I mean, the right business decision, whether to ask for permission before launching, you know, may change city to city. And we see that today with the scooter companies, right? Where cities flex their muscle to impound scooters, for example. Scooter companies ask for permission, right? They're yeah. responding to the city.
Yeah.
But when they don't, and that's true, you know, where I live, they just dump the scooters where they want because who's going to stop them? They're not getting stopped.
But that still leaves the question about what role citizens should be playing in this city versus startup tug of war.
You're right. It's rare that citizens have a direct say in all of this. They just wake up and there are scooters on their doorstep.
Well, that's where Austin provides such an interesting case study because it's one of the few cities where people actually had the chance to vote up or down, whether they wanted these companies in their city or not.
But in that case, well, didn't the direct democracy experiment sort of fail there?
Yeah.
I mean, after voting Uber and Lyft down and then supporting their locally grown versions, like Austinites just ditched local guys and flocked back to Uber and Lyft as soon as the Texas state government let them come back to town. It's like they voted down their own votes.
I think that goes to show sometimes people actually vote with their wallets differently than they vote with their ballots. So for me, then, the question is whether cities should make decisions based on how many customers or how many voters these companies acquire. Those are different numbers.
They're totally different. People are also irrational. But listen, we all know that voter turnout is super low in the U.S., so I'm not sure voters are that reliable, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, what, 20% or something of eligible voters turn out, you know, to vote for mayoral candidates? It's terrible.
Ugh, that is depressing. But maybe there's a silver lining here. What if all of this civic disruption actually made it easier for people to get more civically engaged? I mean, the fact that Uber gets 20,000 people to sign petitions in city after city is actually pretty inspiring. Maybe that's like training wheels for democracy.
I like that, but I take it a step further. If it's so easy to get people to use their phones to express support for Uber and Lyft, what if they could use those same phones to vote? Now that would be a game changer.
That's it for this week. We talked about both Airbnb and scooters today, so I want to note again that I was the first policy person at Airbnb, and I've also advised the scooter startup Spin.
Next week, we'll be taking you off the grid into our battery-powered future.
It's Battery City on next week's episode of Technopolis. Until then, I'm Jim Capsis.
And I'm Molly Turner. Nicole Fladow is the City Lab editor and our light in the darkness. Virginia Laura is our associate producer. Lizzie Jacobs is our executive producer. Josh Rogozin is our engineer. And our theme music is by Copilot.
And thanks to David Dudley for his sage advice. While you wait for next week's show, you can go to citylab.com for top-notch reporting on all the topics we discuss here today.
And so you make sure to catch the next episode. Remember to subscribe to Technopolis on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. And tell a friend.